So we're starting up now with Haley and Colleen from High Court, who have been with us since the morning and led us in the inversion workshop, and my very good friend Amy Chang, who just got here and brought a bunch of egg tarts and milk tea and coffee. So if anybody's hungry, you can also swing by for that. And one of the reasons I wanted to get you guys all together was Amy has gone through a couple different careers, in a sense, in my mind, like jumped really amazingly from one or two career paths to another, and is in the middle now of running a very successful winery called Nine Sons in Napa. And Haley and Colleen are, I think, in the middle of starting up an incredible business that we've been lucky enough to work with you guys on. And so hopefully there's some overlap and interest between you guys. But I think one way I'd love to start is just if you guys could kind of introduce yourselves and say what you're up to now and literally like even this week, kind of what your job entailed you guys to do. So we can start with Amy.
Before I start, Dong, talking about my experience, I just want to take a quick minute to really commend you and the entire Food Radio Office Hours team.
Thanks, Amy.
It's been, so I'm not only a guest, I've been an avid listener all week long, and it's been the perfect antidote to my midterm election anxiety.
Yes.
Don't forget to vote.
Vote November 6th.
November 6th. Yeah. I'm talking to you, millennials. I'm going to take a lot of shit for that. But in all seriousness, something we were just talking about, I think particularly, you know, considering this period of extreme socio-political divide, we can't underestimate the positive impact that connecting with another human being offers. And I really feel like I've gained a lot of intimacy, even through people sharing personal stories on your radio show. So awesome. Huge thank you to you and your guests.
Thank you, Amy.
Yeah. It's, and I think that's a good way to sort of intro into the themes of this interview.
Awesome.
Slash therapy session.
With our scholars rock.
So this week is actually the busiest week at Nine Sons Winery. I live and have lived in New York City for 15 years. Came out here for architecture school. But I work in California. The winery is in St. Helena. I work with my two brothers and my sister-in-law and our winemaker, Lloyd, who's awesome, dealing with the family business. But it's just a really small team, and we release our wine online once a year. And so that wine e-commerce piece opened up this on Tuesday this week. So it's sort of a flurry of e-commerce activity, so sales receipt processing.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what are, like, the weeds of what you actually do day-to-day in this period?
Downloading receipts, confirming money was transacted into our bank account.
Right.
And then it's all about fulfillment, actually. So, you know, for me, it's been really an interesting process to move from a service-based industry, which is architecture, into product and inventory. Huge change, but I find that my design education prepared me really, really well to sort of think about systems. So I head up finance, some of the operations, although my wonderful sister-in-law, who was actually a former pharmacist, a master at inventory, now runs our inventory at the winery. And then I work on design. So there's a lot of design involved in sort of packaging, web photography, labels, you know, any of our collateral material. And certainly the biggest piece was in which I got involved was the design of the building that the winery itself that we built about 5 years ago. Yeah, started that process 5 years ago.
And just to clarify, before you guys started Nine Sons, did you have any experience in the wine industry?
Drinking.
First-hand experience.
And growing up in Lodi, California, which is part of the San Joaquin Valley, the agricultural center of California. And I grew up in a grape-growing town, famous for Zinfandel, kind of ruined Zinfandel for me, period. like farming, and then, I mean, sort of a circuitous path, maybe we can get into in a bit, but farming has, like, come into my academic experience, and I think it in some ways pops up through architecture, and then, you know, it sort of feels full circle now to actually be farming.
But that theme of dogs barking, I think that theme of diving into something that you didn't have the kind of direct, literal training or experiences
None.
In.
We learned on the job. actually all of us, including our winemaker, because we sort of threw him into the business side. He did an amazing job, is doing an amazing job on that.
And it's been really nice to hear. Actually, a lot of the guests, I think, have a similar, when they switch paths or actually start something new, they haven't done that before. Mm-hmm. It's obviously with Haley and Colleen, I think, I mean, my guess is you've never started a giant 30, 35,000 square foot fitness, wellness, social club before.
Not yet.
What were your guys's, where did you guys come from in terms of what were you doing before? What's your kind of background before you joined forces for this?
Before we started High Court, I was in an industry that I really enjoyed. I had joined a company that was a buying scout for international department stores. And I really loved that. It's kind of my early 20s, you know, getting the fashion obsession thing out of you. And then I moved to a company called the Toby Report that really opened my eyes to thinking about the market from the consumer point of view. I had never really considered how many different types of consumers there are and how you can't just put everyone in one big category of millennials and, you know, generationally. So I spent a lot of time with that company trying to introduce different ways to talk to customers. And then when Colleen had this little idea, I realized that all the fun extras that I was trying to get our retail clients to use their physical space for, that we could do it ourselves. So that's kind of how we realized that we needed the core of our business to be like a large actual physical brick and mortar space versus just starting in kind of fleeting pop-ups or fleeting events. We knew that we needed one big clubhouse, one hub. And then we kind of backed into becoming real estate developers essentially now. And that's all Colleen's input. She's essentially...
Is that what you did before High Court?
No, not even.
No, she taught herself.
Yeah. I was living in New York for almost 10 years working in finance. So I had a very traditional banking, private equity finance route. And my quality of life was pretty low because, you know, everyone, no matter what industry you're in, you're putting your all in, especially the first 10 years of your career, even if you're jumping around, you are okay with living in a 500 square foot apartment, having roommates, spending time socially come second. And when I did have the time to choose things for outside of my career, I was looking for a space that had community, had culture, had some sort of balance that I could find, and it wasn't there yet. So that's kind of what we put together, the plan for it. And the past year has really put us into the real estate development route of finding a building, finding people who will help us build it, and a landlord who will believe in us. Mm.
And maybe this is kind of open question for actually all three of you, but whether it's wine or real estate development or kind of wellness and social world, I mean, you guys could have certainly gotten into those endeavors without starting your own version of it. Why did you start your own version of it? Like, why was it important that you're like, I need to, or we need to be the ones to start and run this, as opposed to working for another winery or working for a different club or a different developer in some way first?
Well, I could speak specifically to Colleen. She has been cut out to run her own business since she was like 10 years old. Her, you know, playing house was always setting up small businesses in our dad's office or in our house and having me do the paperwork filing. She would have me answer the phones for her and literally...
Fake callers.
Yeah. It was a real estate agency at one point.
How old were you when you were setting up a real estate agency?
Like 10 years old.
Yeah, I think I was like 12. It was after school. We would go by my dad's office. He set something up in our hometown to be closer to us. And we would go by, and at like between like 3 and 4, I would sit in one of the empty desks and just pretend I was taking calls.
And
from
then
people.
She would put me down in the so basement and say, "You file this for me. Highlight all these papers." And I was like, "Yes."
Yeah, it feels good to have.
She has that spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit,
And it feels good to have a team too. Like one of the reasons that helped us say we want to do this, or me say I want to do this, is because nights and weekends were spent with me and Haley, just thinking about how we're going to build this together. And to be able to do something on your own is without the support of a co-founder, especially, we doubled down through the support of a family member. You feel really secure, and you feel like no matter what, we have each other. So that helped.
Yeah, family business was definitely what kept us knowing that this was going to work. And then I think also the fact that Colleen mentioned our dad had opened an accounting firm in our town so he could be closer to us. And that always stuck in our minds as being able to see him have a flexible schedule for us, for our after school activities and for being able to see us. So that was like always a little bit, we felt like when we were adults that would be the best idea, but we had no idea how we would start our own business. But the idea of doing it yourself was always with us.
Was that family aspect also related to why you guys, I mean, you didn't need to necessarily set a winery with your family, but obviously the opportunity was there.
Yeah. So family business is a tough thing. It's like the best and worst of both worlds.
Sure.
The best because you're working with people that you trust implicitly. That can be hard to find, or it might take multiple business partners to find that kind of relationship. But you know, you're trying to have a meeting and you're still upset about when someone didn't empty the dishwasher, you know, when you're 6 years old, so it can cause problems too.
Yeah, we'll double down for you. We live together too.
I would say, yeah, so I work with, you know, it's my two brothers. And I want to say that there was never, a specific intention to be an entrepreneur, but I guess when you sort of look at your parents, my dad was actually an engineer with General Mills working on Cheerios.
Cool.
But then he always had something going on the side. And, you know, my mom's kind of same thing. She ended up, she was, working in, public health administration, and then eventually stayed home with us, but like basically like, you know, ran a ton of school events. And so there wasn't a time, I want to say even since I started working, like gainfully employed, where I sort of didn't have a day job, which was me employed by someone else. Or it could be, you know, like when I was a student, I was going to school, that transitioned into being an architect with a day job at an office. Certainly becoming a parent. I'm a mom to two children. Those are like full-time jobs. And then you sort of, I've always thought that being your own boss is a state of mind. So when I was employed by everybody else, I was constantly like collecting data. So I will like mine the company server for contracts, HR forms. So like, you know, I think it was just trying to look and see how other businesses run. And it was more out of curiosity versus a desire to run my own show.
Not everyone pays attention to those details.
Yeah. So to me, it was like really interesting. And so again, like it's a state of mind. I was employed by someone else, but I was very much thinking like, how is this business working? What's going on behind the scenes? And then I think I've always pursued, again, I think sort of since middle school, you know, some kind of volunteer activity that's community-based. So really trying to align my personal agenda and what's fulfilling to me as a like more holistically in my life. And then like to sort of pursue an intellectual endeavor, which has a product though. So whether that's teaching, academic research with a professor, small projects for like cultural institutions. So again, it wasn't sort of like so intentional to be an entrepreneur, so to speak. Things just happened, and you know, our motto, me and my brothers, has always sort of been like, do it yourself. And it's because, you know, learning and doing it yourself, despite all of the challenges of that, is what makes it fun. And it doesn't feel like work then.
So there wasn't a moment before you guys started Nine Sons where you're like, I need to start something on my own or with someone else even, but I need to be my own boss. It just kind of...
I will say it wasn't a conscious decision, but I think we all knew we were capable of it. And so there, I think that is actually really important, is having that kind of confidence and ability, like, you know, desire or appetite for risk, because it is. It impacts your life immensely to sort of leave your day job, so to speak, and run your own show.
Yeah, it's a huge hurdle, just saying, I can do this. And there's no one that is going to be your cheerleader more than a family member.
That's true. Yeah.
Was there
Hopefully.
So that period of getting Nine Sons off the ground, were you still working somewhere else?
Oh, yes. I was working here in New York City. I had left my architecture job and wanted to actually move full-time onto the winery, but sort of got roped into... I actually worked as like a director of operations at Van Allen Institute for about 9 months. And that's when I learned bookkeeping through YouTube videos because no one else could do it. But again, you know, that's sort of how these startups go. All of that experience sort of rolled into the winery. And so I was still working out here with Van Allen, and then would fly out to California working with our architect, interior designer, and then the graphic design team on our brand identity for about 2 years. And then made the transition. I went back to school actually to study wine business. And that's when I sort of officially, you know, became part of the wine industry.
That was going back to school. That was, I guess, after you guys had decided to start the winery. It wasn't like,
yeah,
you went back
we were in construction, figuring
out
our
babies at this time.
I had a son who, so I commuted every weekend for about 18 months to go to school and an executive MBA program at Sonoma State.
That is so impressive.
It was hugely educational, not from a skills standpoint, but having the West Coast vibe of, people just out there in business school, you know, my classmates led with a very different energy than what you find out on the East Coast. Like when they introduce themselves, the first thing they say is, I have two children and, you know, I've been married to my lovely wife for 15 years. I enjoy canoeing. and then you sort of get into the nuts and bolts
like
of their
what
career.
Do you do?
Yeah, the stuff New Yorkers make fun of.
Yeah. So I learned a lot about work-life balance. Prioritizing sort of what do I want? And again, sort of holistically speaking, not compartmentalizing work and personal life. So I think ironically, and you know, I think farming and wine are the perfect venues in which you can sort of enjoy those or think, have time to think about those other aspects of career. And so that was really my biggest takeaway. So I was in school. Again, it was really great. We were sort of developing our business strategy, our sales strategy, our pricing strategy, our tasting experience, and I was able to test out a lot of those ideas through school. And so that was a really great example of going back to school, like sort of a pivot. It's a huge undertaking and resource, you know, sink to go back to school when you're sort of switching careers. Mm-hmm. But I found it hugely invaluable. And so from there, you know, we sort of formalized roles and sort of divided and conquered in terms of running the business.
Do you remember? So, I mean, besides obviously the mountain of new knowledge you had to learn just to run, I mean, first a vineyard, then build a winery and run a winery and all of that. I mean, there's, I'm sure, lots of technical skills, business skills. Do you remember, I have so many questions about that switch, but do you remember what the first, once you're like, okay, I guess we're going to start a winery now, what the first thing you did was that was in the direction of the winery? Like, was it like pick up a book? Like, was it a YouTube video?
Wine mentor.
Like, how do you,
drinking?
What's that first step?
Drinking again?
Or did you visit a lot of wineries?
I will say we were, I mean, I think this is really important. We worked internally as a team on our brand identity and our mission and vision. And it helped us coalesce as a team around what we wanted to do, not only as a wine project, in relation to other family-owned businesses in Napa, but as our own family and sort of like deal breakers, like, what's more important, the business or family? So there is like something really valuable in having a family business because you get to sort of the heart of the business really quickly. And again, I think it's an amazing opportunity to align sort of your own values with how you act, you know, out in the world as well as through your business. So.
Why leave architecture? Because I'm asking because I think that what I like is that it's such a completely different industry. It's not something you expect. It's not like a clear lead in from architecture into running a wine business, even though a lot of the skills kind of transfer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, funny you say that, Dong, because I think, again, going back to business school, and again, you know, again, a wine business program, and there are only two or so in the world, so it's not well known, but that kind of education brought a lot of value to my architectural education. You know, I feel like architects who study and practice, and then, like, if they were to go into other fields, it would be incredible for the world, because of the way we're taught to think and problem solve and sort of have optimistic visions for the future and for society, and it's an ability to communicate through multiple means, speaking in terms of presentation, visuals, data. It's profound, actually. And so for me, it was incredibly valuable to sort of take a step outside of design and find sort of a new energy or sort of strengths in a different profession. So I actually really believe in design education as a springboard to, you know, sort of non-traditional non-design professions. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, so...
But why architect? Again, I think it was very organic. It did, you know, none of this was planned. Mm. I think...
Was there something like missing from architecture for you?
No. It's sort of like, hey, again, I think, I think this is very much part of design education, right? It's about problem solving. And so there's, in a way, in my mind, I don't have a notion that I'm sort of stuck in a box about what I can do. And so it literally was sort of like, hey, Amy, we're going to build a winery. We're growing some grapes. We're selling the fruit to other vintners. But let's do our own thing. Can you help us pick an architect?
Who was that?
I think it was like my brother, my youngest brother, and my dad.
Oh, I thought it was you. No. You were talking to yourself. Anyway.
Do not talk to myself. No. So I was literally like approached by, you know, members of my family saying, hey, Amy, can you help us out on this? And then it's like, hey, Amy, can you oversee like selection of the consultants? Hey, Amy, can you weigh in on the design? You know, it sort of just kind of snowballed.
Mm-hmm. How much of the design did you take a part in, or the architecture work that was needed?
Much to our local architect's chagrin, too much. I think architects are like the worst clients.
I mean, I can imagine you probably had more experience in.
So, I mean, but the cool thing was he was actually breaking off and just starting his own practice. So, like, we worked with a team of people who were really just all starting in their own business. So there was a lot of, like, trial and error and learning to work together. But that was part of the process. That was so amazing. I would imagine you all are in the same situation when it comes to real estate and sort of what you're doing. But I guess there was, like, no fear about just jumping in. Mm-hmm. You don't know how to do it? Go find a YouTube video. You know, like, sit, you know, it is long hours, like, trying to figure things out. It's, as you said, like, very, like, nitty-gritty nuts and bolts in the weeds to run a business. But again, I think it's so fun, so interesting. It's a new challenge every day, for better or for worse. But
yeah. So, I mean, I could keep bugging you for a while, because we haven't even gotten past like that switch to winemaking. But I wanted to give you guys a chance if you had any like things you wanted to pick from Amy's brain.
I'm just still listening.
I liked what you said about how you knew your career in architecture didn't put you in a box, and that you had so many more skills that you knew you could apply to something else.
Sure.
I found that in finance too, that everyone who works in investment banking and in private equity, the roles that I were doing were for clients. Mm-hmm. We still have clients just like the way you would have had with your architecture. And you get, let's just call it a deal we were trying to make. We're trying to sell a basket of assets that were all not ours that we owned, but that we got very intimately involved with the owners of those companies. And it was a train that was running in Florida. It was engines from an airplane manufacturer. And we valued those assets and we got very close to the companies. And then once the transactions were done, we kind of set them off into their next life. And there was this part of me that was like, I just did so much, me and my team, right? Like, mm-hmm. we just did so much developing this deal, thinking about the future for them, rebranding them, you know, recapitalizing them, being on site with them. And then it kind of, you know, it got put into 2016's folders of accomplishments, and then 2017 came around. It was whole new things. And for me, I wanted to stick around with the work that we had done. I had a little bit of consulting before that, where we did restructuring consulting during the 2007-2008 recession. And I spent so much blood, sweat, and tears with these professionals making their companies operate better in and out of bankruptcy or whatever it may be. And then you come back to your desk, and I was left with like a hole. Where I was like, okay, I would kind of want to go still do what I was doing there. So that it never really made me think I want to be an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. but it made me think that the skills that I have and the stuff that we were working on, what if I just stuck with that and saw it grow even more?
Sure. Sort of based on what you just said, I'm going to take it back to what really matters, which is food. I think one thing Asians do really well is share and enjoy food together, just as a side note. But today I brought in yuanyang, which is the Chinese word for mandarin ducks, like the breed of bird. And that symbolizes lovers. But in this case, yuanyang is one of my favorite Hong Kong style beverages. It's half milk tea, half coffee. It's delicious.
That sounds so good.
It's really
is
good.
It like meant to be a love affair between tea and
yes,
coffee?
Yes, Dong's got it. Yes.
That design
the Chinese
education.
Guy cheating. so yuanyang, like more broadly, symbolizes the pairing of things that make a really good match. And I'm sort of listening to what you're saying about having seemingly disparate professional experiences, or it could even be your life experiences. And I think one of the best things about being an entrepreneur, and maybe it's a skill you need to have in a way, is to be able to connect the dots. And so, I mean, and then I'm also sort of thinking about self-identity. I don't know if that's something you can choose, right? It starts at a very, very young age. But I very much think about, like, you know, in my case, yuanyang is like representative of my cultural heritage. My mom is Caucasian, born and raised in Iowa, and my dad is ethnically Shanghainese, born in Hong Kong, raised in Tokyo, and then came to New York City actually for college. So I think sort of about that identity. And then again, sort of my career path has been very much an aggregation of these seemingly random work experiences that add up to something that you can't plan for and you cannot sort of even anticipate. And, you know, again, I don't like these are not things you can sort of go after. They're part of your experience starting from a very young age. But I think from a very young age, I never fit into, I was always the checkbox other mm-hmm. in the way I looked, in the other type of people around me, in the path that I've pursued. And I've just, you know, always been comfortable with that, despite the naysayers and, you know.
Was that kind of awareness or consciousness of your identity a driver for any of the professional decisions you took? Or was it just always something that was there?
It's. I think it's more there, in the sense that I get a lot of weird looks, like wine. Like, you know, I mean, I would even say there are a couple of conversations we had, Dong, where a lot of my friends here in New York are like, "What do you mean you're going into the wine business?" It doesn't. There's nothing. There's like no sort of logic behind it. But to me, again, it's been about connecting the dots. So you can sort of take, even from like a childhood experience of growing up in Lodi, California, a grape town, to sort of end up now, decades later, being a vintner.
A grape town.
Yeah, you just never know when these things can. So I think to me, it's about you see the opportunities, and when that door opens, you walk through it. And that might mean you need to be walking through multiple doors at once, which takes a lot of grit and self-sacrifice. But I think then there's a moment, as I'm about like to turn 40 next year, where these things can coalesce, and that's pretty exciting. And I think that to me is the goal.
So actually, with that, there was obviously the moment where you more or less dropped architecture to start the wine business.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, you were in architecture as a profession in various capacities for a little while, right?
Yeah, I'm still licensed in California. And again, that's something I don't have to do, maintain my license, but I do, because you just never know when that might pop up again. Yeah, but we studied undergrad architecture together as well as getting a master's. And then I really focused here in New York, working at corporate firms, again, to sort of get them to pay for my licensing exams. And to basically steal all of their, contracts,
but
sort of like how they operate their business. Not right. To steal, it's to take a look under the hood.
Were you doing things, because even from undergrad up until Nine Sons was started, that trajectory through architecture was relatively linear? I mean, in terms of you were staying within the architecture profession anyway, but wasn't.
And actually listening to all of your guests this week has helped me think very much. I haven't thought about this. So to go back and sort of think through the process, I was never really committed to doing something. I'm not somebody who's like goal-based with a 5-year plan, 1-year plan. So again, that's personality. But going back to high school, like I wanted to be in the fine arts or a musician or a dancer, and having an Asian father, that was not acceptable. Those are not quote unquote careers. So he was like, go to architecture school. So, I did it. And to be honest, we were at Cal. It was not my favorite, academic area. I, in fact, almost got a minor in Japanese language, civil engineering. I took pest management.
Pest management
and was reading like the theory of biodynamic farming. So, all these sort of like disparate interests have come together. And then I think it was our last studio, actually, at Cal. We read French philosophy, and I was hooked. And so I'm like, oh, now I'm going to go to grad school.
Was that with Robbie?
With Robbie, yeah. I had no intention to go on to grad school. I thought I would just, like, work in the nonprofit sector somehow, like community design centers. Things would shift really quickly, but when the shift happened, I would just be off, like gone, running to the next thing. And so I think the same thing with, then came out to, I really just wanted to get to New York City, as most of us do. And sort of going through grad school here, I kind of knew I wanted to go in corporate design, but with what end in sight, I can't say. It was, again, sort of just trying to keep moving and doing different things.
What did you want to do again before your dad said go to architecture school?
Be a backup
dancer
in hip hop videos.
I can see that. I can totally see that.
I mean,
I would
say, again, like this thinking this week, I was like, there's probably 15 career paths I wanted to pursue and still may. Mm-hmm. Matchmaker was another one of them.
I feel like you do that kind of on the side anyway.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. A lot
you have
of
a good success rate?
I have 100% success rate, but I've only matched one. No time to do any other.
The data's in your favor.
Yeah, very selective with the clientele.
Yes, very selective. So I think this is an interesting thing for all the listeners out there, especially people who are sort of like, how do you like make that decision and jump the hurdle to like do something? You don't have to be the best at. In fact, I think my brothers and I really empathize with each other. We like to do a lot of things and we could do it well, but we were definitely not sort of like the best, the top 5% performers. Mm-hmm. And I think today in such a metric-driven society where we're really looking at resumes and one definition of excellence, you don't have to be there, so to speak, to take the leap. Actually, it takes a lot more sort of like internal work about confidence, resilience.
Yeah, character building.
Absolutely. It's sort of like a lot of like work on yourself that I think leads to successful entrepreneurs. And it's not about the successes or solving a problem so that it's solved. I think there's this question of like failure. What is failure? Especially when you're running your own business, like that's kind of every day. And the takeaway is really that those difficult situations offer opportunities for growth and learning. And you get to the other side and you're like, that wasn't so bad. I can handle the next challenge. So again, I think there's sort of out in media, there's a perception of what a successful or who a successful entrepreneur is. Mm-hmm. And there are many other definitions of that. So,
yeah. So media will talk about, you know, capital raised, mm-hmm. right. Or the yeah. people are like, you know, the banner people that they have behind them,
mm-hmm. How quickly they did it or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know about you all, but we made a family decision, for example, to not grow. And it's because we didn't want to hire other people. We were happy just sort of at our scale. So we didn't go into national distribution, for example. We're not in every restaurant.
Have that once a year.
We only release our wine once a year online.
That's very cool.
Because that's what our team can manage. We're moving to twice a year, actually, which is like a big stretch for us, actually. So, but again, there's like this notion
that
everyone else is growing.
Of the company?
Absolutely. We feel that our brand is most important, and the relationships with our best customers and other people in the industry takes precedence over what society tells us the rate at which we should be growing.
Is success, right?
Right. And again, we get a lot of like blank looks. So again, it has to do with like the work of knowing yourself and sort of what your own goals are, and mm-hmm. in a way, like not tuning out the naysayers or the haters. There's always going to be a ton of haters. It's kind of just like holding your ground, like take it in, but like know when to pick yourself and move forward with your own agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. So the fact that we're developing something means that we had to, like physically developing a space means that we had to open up our base camp to others, mm-hmm. so that we had to go out and do a pretty big fundraise. Mm-hmm. There's kind of this, because a lot of the things you said in the email, we're focusing on what it's like to be a woman as an entrepreneur. And there's kind of this general understanding around, there's like a phrase, but females are not given the benefit of the doubt when they're trying to start something. Mm-hmm. And you have to prove yourself in order to get people's trust. And men are given the benefit of the doubt right off the bat.
Sure.
And if they fail, that's okay, because they could do a million things. Mm-hmm. And if a woman fails at something or one particular thing, then they're probably going to fail at everything. So there's like a lot more discouragement, and it might not be implicit, but it could be a lot scarier to
absolutely
to kind of like tune people out. And especially in a world where you aren't able to like seclude to just the people who believe in you, and you have to open up and specifically ask other people for help.
Right. Again, it's sort of, this really is like a therapy session.
I'll take it.
a recorded live therapy session.
I think it's just part of the process. And I think one of the things that's most important to remember is, part of the human experience is like things come together and things fall apart, and it's sort of a cycle, and we get through it. And,
how do you get through really bad news?
Cry, right. Play really sad songs.
Like you let yourself be in the bad news.
Absolutely. Right? You have to go through it. Yeah. I think experience it. And then you reach out to your support network. Like, I think it's really important, your business partner, your family, your friends. And that's kind of all we have. And again, just you have to have a lot of belief in yourself and know that this feels really urgent now, but it will pass. And
so
as I like to say, nothing can't be solved on the dance floor.
Nice.
Work it out.
Is there a specific example of bad news or a piece of bad news that you can talk about, that you want to talk about? You don't have to talk about, of course, that, like, because I'm really curious, even like the mechanics of actually getting over that and moving on to something else would be really interesting to hear.
I will tell you, becoming a parent, I have a 6-year-old and a 1-year-old. It sort of shifts your entire perspective about like the urgency of work when you're responsible for another human being's life and future. It gives you a lot of perspective about like work stuff. Got it. I can handle it. but obviously it's been a really great experience in that sense. I think you just have to sort of step out. But this is sort of, again, the human experience, right? As we get older, there's something really powerful in surrendering to the reality that things are not in our control. Yes. And that can be anything from like someone's not going to buy your product, you lose the lease on your apartment, someone's going to break your heart. I'm speaking more, I guess, about life stuff, because in the bigger picture, life stuff is what really matters.
And the way you deal with life stuff is ultimately how you're going to deal with your business stuff.
I totally agree. And I think that's one of the keys, especially if you're sort of small family business in particular, it's so much of life and work is intertwined, which I see as a huge plus.
Yep.
But you have to know that all these things can happen and it doesn't like ruin your life, mm-hmm. right? Your life's, we're here and then we die. So right. in your time here on earth, like, what are you going to do? And I think if you keep, for me, I'm like, you just put as much love out into the universe as possible. And it gives you some perspective, like, okay, this is really challenging. We had all sorts of stuff happen. Like, you know, alcohol is the most regulated industry in the United States. We definitely did not have our papers filed correctly, and we could have been shut down, you know, right when we're starting. I can't even tell you. Yeah, bureaucracy.
Trying to start a business.
Yeah, just the paperwork alone. Construction nightmares that you can't even imagine. I mean, my God, like last year this time, there were fires in Napa. We got evacuated, and my brothers called me around 3 a.m. the first night of the fire. We could see the flames from our security camera. It was the middle of harvest. But again, how do you handle that? Like, this was really like a crisis, actually. We could lose the entire crop because harvest wasn't, picking was not done, to smoke taint. It can affect both the fruit plus the juice that was already fermenting or in barrel. We lost electricity. Again, when you need all that
money
cooling.
At that problem either.
No,
there's
nothing to do. We couldn't be there. We were like, it could be all gone. You know, all the buildings could be gone by tomorrow. But again, instead of freaking out about it, we freaked out for like 30 minutes. This is again,
That's
3 a.m. in the morning. And then we're like, what's plan B? What's plan C? And so, you know, literally my brother was out on a plane to Arizona, I think a couple of days later, learning how to grow weed in a greenhouse. And so we're like, we're going to be a cannabis business.
And for some reason, even though that may have been a long shot, who knows, maybe you're doing it on the side, having that feeling.
Getting his backup ready.
Yeah, you get your backup ready. That gives you kind of.
So that's what I'm talking about. It's like, which creative professionals have a huge advantage compared to a lot of other traditional white collar professions. We can think outside the box. So again, and then like, you know, after the sort of stress of that moment subsided, we looked back, it was like so fun. We were like coming up with a business plan, running the numbers, checking out how to grow cannabis. Where are we going to get the permits? How do we lobby like Napa County? So we were like moving on it.
Took your mind off it.
Yeah. But we also felt like we got this because we're doing something about it. I think that's hugely important. Again, like your best laid plans are never going to turn out. Right. So
yeah, I can't tell you how many times Colleen and I have distracted each other while we have to wait like 4 days, 5 days to get like this one big piece of news back.
Right.
So then we'll just like, we'll take our fear to like the furthest extent and be like, okay, so then let's just say we're actually going to do this out of a bodega in the middle of Times Square. How mm-hmm. do we do? And like, we'll just figure out what like the smallest, most fractional possible way we could make this work.
Right.
And then by the time that we get the good news and everything's okay. Yeah. And it's like, well, at least we figured out the backup plan.
And maybe it comes into play later. So right. I think there is not a time when you're being creative in terms of business planning that you're not producing valuable work, because it will come again. It's like that connecting the dots. It will come back into the picture at some point.
Yeah.
Do you have, so jumping like way back in terms of before college, and maybe even before that, do you remember going through doing anything sort of like entrepreneurial as a kid, or actually doing things where you had to kind of already start testing these skills and you are applying in terms of, I'm sure it wasn't that conscious, but like, okay, if something goes wrong, start planning for something else,
I think,
or pulling that trigger to run with something.
I think that's that multi-prong approach of work. So like volunteering, doing something like intellectually satisfying. And then I think back to middle school, the first dollar made question that you had brought up, Dong. I was babysitting, but I worked in a neighborhood where there are a lot of Mormon families. And I quickly discovered and strategically, you know, bartered myself to babysit for the Mormon families because they had lots of kids, which meant I got paid a lot more. And most of the parents worked at Goldman Sachs.
Did you get paid per kid?
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. and you know, I coincidentally or not, I opened my first like Goldman Sachs investment brokerage account when I was in high school with like the scraps of like a couple thousand dollars I had, you know, earned through odd jobs. But it was sort of like those connections, right? And and then my money was working for me at that point. So
wow, capitalist, I like it.
Yes, yes. So do you? So I think that thinking of like, you can't rely on plan A and B. Actually, you have to have like five plan A and plan Bs, and they're all on different tracks. And again, it's sort of seemingly disparate, but at some point they're going to merge. Yeah.
Did you have? Sorry, go ahead. Did you have anybody that was a model, woman or otherwise, that you're like, oh, she's doing something kind of incredible, and she's actually able to do this on her own when you were growing up, that you could look to? I mean, maybe you didn't even know her, but or not so much.
I think it had to do more, again, sort of, this goes more to the cultural identity. Not seeing anyone who looked like me, besides my brothers. So there was, that was in fact for me, I didn't feel the urge that I needed to be like other people. In fact, I felt quite liberated to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. So I was definitely always like the weird kid doing her own. Like I was unaffected by peer pressure.
That could have gone the opposite way for
you. I know. So again, I'm not sure where that comes from. I think my parents are so radical. I mean, yeah. For like a Chinese dude to mean an Iowan girl in the Midwest. And, you know, when they were deciding to have children, like they were advised by the pediatrician, like, don't have mixed race children. It's going to mess them up, you know.
Really?
Mentally.
What?
Yes. So, right. I mean, like, it was sort of radical what they did just to get married and to procreate.
It's funny that an Iowa lady is, like, radical.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. But truly, sort of, there weren't... I always felt other. And for me, again, that was quite liberating. Mm. Or I didn't feel pressure to be like anyone else. I think it led to paths of exploration. It could be through the way I dressed. It could be through the things that I did. There was no status quo.
Was there a point in your career or your life where you kind of like stopped feeling like the other? Was it like the classic moving to New York story or...
I think actually, to be honest, like going to UC Berkeley is the first time I felt like I could belong. And then in fact, I didn't. So
that was a letdown.
Yeah, that was like my identity crisis time. You know, even though you're have some kind of Chinese blood, like the Chinese all segregated, like Chinese from Taiwan, Chinese who went to the specific school in Taiwan. But I found an amazing group of people in architecture. I think we were diverse. It wasn't about that. And so it became self-expression through what you produced. Again, I think that's one of the amazing things about creative, academic experiences. As you're going through the process of self, like discovering your self-identity, you have all these avenues in which you can express yourself and like experiment. And that was really sort of the basis of the curriculum. So I'm a like I said, I'm a huge advocate for maker curriculum in, you know, elementary and middle schools now.
What's that?
Well, maker...
Like, I could assume, but I want to hear.
Maker is, again, just project or sort of problem-based. You work in teams. It could be something as simple as sort of like coding, building something like Tinkerbot. There are all sorts of ways, but it can go through like social sciences as well. It's really this idea that there's no solution and you're not learning from a teacher telling you. It's really through doing something and iterative process and sort of you try something, you test it out, and then you stop and have a discussion and think about what worked and what didn't. And collaborating like, hey, I have this idea or so-and-so over there, Figure this piece out. Can we try to add that in? So it's like a completely different way of thinking.
That totally falls out after like kindergarten with like blocks and painting than you when you move into
sure
traditionally, but it's great to bring it back in.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense whether your kids feel that kind of otherness or lack of otherness in New York, growing up in New York?
Well, I'm a huge advocate for public school. I mean, you're kind of going to go down the rabbit hole with me here, Dong, on this one.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, so New York City, although it's one of the most diverse public school systems in the country, is also one of the most segregated. And my son attends our zone public school on the Upper West Side, although it's in a neighborhood that's been historically segregated, immigrant children and people of color, literally sort of the lines drawn and put into attendance at the school that we attend. Additionally, so it's been underserved financially and under-enrolled and cast sort of by the outside neighborhood, which tends to be like an up-and-coming, really affluent neighborhood. So the neighborhood I live in is actually where West Side Story took place. It's originally called San Juan Hill. Again, there's kind of a gentrification process that's happened. There's a lot of public housing there. And the question is really like, how do you bring equality and curricular activities to underserved or marginalized students? So again, I'm less focused. I don't want my kids in private school because I think the more difficult thing to learn is actually the social, and I think this applies to us as adults, as professionals, like, what is your own standard of excellence? Like, who am I? What do I stand for? How am I sort of going to treat other people? Like, truly, like, empathy, kindness.
You want to put morals in there?
I think, what is your responsibility for civic engagement, social justice? Like, there are a lot of pieces that I think are really important in today's society. And that's part of the public school system. Our new school's chancellor is one of his four pillars is sort of like anti-bias and equity in schools. So I think about that all the time. It's very much based on my own experience going to some of the worst public schools in the United States, actually, when I was growing up in Lodi. I think that very much has contributed to my quote unquote grit as an entrepreneur. So again, having some perspective about like what is really urgent, when you're sending that email Monday morning in all caps, like this needs to be done now. Like, no, it's not, when you have some perspective again about like the life piece. I grew up in a really rough neighborhood and, I was afraid to go to sleep every night just for my own safety. There's a totally different perspective on,
what's important.
Sure. What's important. Or what are you going to get stressed out about?
Yeah. So. Will your son go through the high school system?
Yes. I plan on it. Both my kids. Yeah. So in terms of there being sort of other, I think they're very fortunate to be in a place where there is no majority, let's say. So in many ways, I do find that their experience might parallel mine, but in fact, I think it's much more enriched. I mean, they are a school that takes on maker curriculum. Mm. And again, the whole point of maker is that it's sort of like equalizing. It has no borders, right? You can learn in many different ways and still succeed, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Do they change the subjects?
No,
the subjects are the same. It's just the way that
the way it's taught.
The way it's mm-hmm. taught.
Okay. And experienced by the kids.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe this is actually more of a question for when you were your kids' age, mm-hmm. or even from there, let's say, through until Berkeley, and especially being Hapa, mm-hmm. Do you recall pressure that you put on yourself to either be more Asian or less Asian?
Well, first of all, I don't look Asian. I've got green eyes. So even the Chinese people are like, no, you're not Chinese. So I think that was like the first time I sort of felt like, hey, but I am, right? Why do I need to prove myself?
Was there a specific moment this happened?
That happened multiple times when I was at Berkeley. I think there was a lot of micro segregation, again, sort of like even within Chinese, subdivision of like social groups was very much based on where you're from and what your experience was. And I remember going to like the Hapa club and I'm just like, I'm only hanging out with these people because they look like me, and which was weird.
What does Hapa stand for?
Oh, that's a Hawaiian term for half Asian, an Asian mix, okay. Basically ethnic mix. So again, I think I went through a lot of like identity crisis, in college. It was my first experience of that. Whereas, you know, I think the kids are not actually colorblind. They understand that there's difference, but I never felt like I needed to be the same, let's say. But maybe the first time I felt that was in college, more because there was like rejection from all these different groups. But again, I found my home in architecture, in like with my design classmates, who again, were all sort of like the weird kids spray painting the hallway and, you know, like, you know, sort of, it was like inherent in what we do that we're sort of different. And that was okay. That was accepted.
Well, even, I mean, that basic question of like, who am I? I was thinking, I feel like, especially when you're developing, when you're young, so much of that is answered by seeing someone else that is some version of you, like a reflection of you or someone you want to be like, at least. And you're like, oh, I'm kind of like that person or a version of that person. I'm my own person, but I'm kind of like that person. Then when that person doesn't exist, when there isn't really someone that looks like you. Or someone that you want to be like that looks like you, I can imagine that the answer for that identity question is much harder to precisely figure out. Like, you're not like, oh, I mean, obviously people's kind of identity changes, but there isn't a clear reflection back.
That's true.
A clear answer on the table for you. And I feel like there's a correlation with a lot of people that get into creative fields.
Sure, I agree.
Like, even architecture, it's not like that community is people that look like me or look like you, but there is suddenly an aligned value system of what you're interested in or what you're producing. And that's where you see the kind of yourself in that work.
Yes. In something that you've created.
Cause I feel like
to how you look.
Right. Cause something I never really thought about, but obviously it's really apparent is that correlation between people that are other of some version and artistic field. And anytime in media, like there always is, that's always where the first kind of representation of someone who's different is in some version of an arts, I feel like, whether it's music or visual art or something like that.
I think the key really is at a young age, just more exposure to many different people, experiences, professions. Like, I mean, to be honest, even sitting in my wine MBA class, you know, I was like, you know, I just learned how many professions there are just within the wine industry. Like, I should have gone into law school and been a wine attorney. You know, I mean, there's so many interesting things that we just don't know about. You sort of only hear about the major professions or you're on track to go to, like, to this college and study. You know, I mean, there's so many interesting careers out there. And I think if you can have access to mentors who talk about the different things that they've done, and that's ongoing. Like, even as an adult, I'm still learning. And again, that's why I'm loving this radio show. Like, I've just learned so much about other people's journeys, and it really informs your own, or can inform your own.
I felt that for a while I felt like college failed me, but I feel like I kind of failed myself during college for not, like, really digging deeper and spending more time and finding a niche. Like, I wrote for the entertainment section of the newspaper, but I didn't spend any time making that something that I felt better about and I wanted to actually change. And I got a communications degree, and there's like, it's so easy to kind of just like sit in a box in college and not,
or get on a track.
Yeah. And you never find out until, you know, your 30s that you could have been a wine attorney.
But maybe it's not too late.
Yeah, that's right.
But, now you know about wine attorneys.
But you have to know exactly what you want to be by the time that it's like second semester freshman year, and
that's true. But I think again, that's something society tells us we have to do. Obviously, there's like financial resource allocation that's involved in that as well. But
for sure,
you know, I definitely don't think wine will be my last career, you know, at all. In fact, I think there could be 3 or 4 more. And that's exciting to me. So I think, again, it's letting go of some notion that you have to get to a certain place and achieve a certain level of success, or, you know, sort of have a specific resume in which to launch or start something. You just, like, do it all. Like, try it, right?
Do you know, are there many women and or minority-run wineries in the U.S.?
I want to say there's a little bit better representation, but the part that I guess, especially in Napa, Sonoma, I will say, and I don't know how I feel about this, that a lot of the female run wineries were often sort of springboarded off of the woman meeting a winemaker, getting married to him, and then sort of like leaving her career path, traditional career path. Okay. And then like, you know, eventually,
family.
Yeah. Or I mean, to be honest, most of the family run businesses are typically male. Yeah. So the patriarchy is still real. Right. I mean, in terms of like people of color, it doesn't exist. I have to be honest about that. And you think about like the migrant labor that supports the entire industry, not just wine, but like agriculture in general in the United States or, you know, in California. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of underrepresentation.
Yeah, there's a lot of fields where I feel like the labor base will spend so many years honing the skill and then be able to start their own version mm-hmm. of the business.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't sound like that's a very...
Well, it has to do with our immigration laws, in fact.
Right.
They're not citizens. They have temporary work visas. I mean, I have to tell you, the wine industry for me has been this amazing experience of sort of all the things I care about coalescing, right? I mean, I'm thinking back to like earlier this year when we had to do an ICE training, like what happens when ICE raids the vineyard and how are we going to handle it as a team? So, you know, in addition to like environmental things, sustainability of like growing water, waste, right? Social issues. We did not name our winery the Chang Family Vineyards, which is pretty common, in fact, is you use your surname when it's a family winery. But we were written up in Wine Spectator, for example, as being the, and they totally got our, they used some other Chinese last name, not Chang Family.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So they misprinted it and they said, we're from China. You're like, no, actually, grew up in Lodi, California, right? So I think again, there is sort of all this like bias that exists. They very much thought we were outsiders, whereas our mission was, you know, is to be part of the community and be contributing and growing the brand of Napa Valley. So no one interviewed us for example, to get that.
I was about to say,
get
yeah.
that information.
They just assumed
straight.
Based on the last name, that
sure,
they knew the story,
right? Or maybe they heard it from a neighbor. I'm not sure. So again, I mean, we were the outsiders.
It has to be so frustrating.
You know, but in a way, okay, it's frustrating. But instead, it sort of gives you a lot of license because no one thinks you're going to be doing anything of value. And like, we came out with like a really great wine. We got like top lot at the Napa Valley auction. I mean, there's some pressure that comes off you when people are like not expecting anything of you. Like, take advantage of that, you know? So rather than seeing that as something you have to sort of fight against, I'm all about like just focus on the assets that you have. And again, it comes from that confidence. Like when you know you're doing something of value that's bigger than yourself, it's going to show itself. It takes some time.
Just to brag about knowing you. So Amy's wine, for people that don't know it or hasn't tried it, it's only carried at French Laundry.
That's correct.
And it's... I don't remember the name of the rating system. But,
oh, the Robert Parker 100-point
like,
system, the guy who invented the 100-point scale.
And yeah. You guys get like 99.
We got 198.
98.
Wow.
So you have room to grow.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Has
you said you brought some of that, right?
Talk to me after the show.
Okay. But it's besides the kind of statistics that it's mm-hmm. an incredible wine, I guess I was curious, like, and maybe this is a good way to kind of end this show, that otherness or outsiderness, whether imposed on you or whether internal from an identity, is it fair to say that's become an advantage in some way? Like,
yeah,
do you find that it's
absolutely.
Like, oh, actually, shit, this is a way we can actually take advantage of this and run with it as
yes.
opposed to suppressing it in some way?
Yes, and I think if you can, you know, yourself or your children get into design thinking, education, maker programs, and certainly the way of the world is like going, you know, towards my ethnic heritage, which is mixed. You know, I think it's just a matter of time for us to, you know, see pretty big shifts in how we view excellence and what we can expect, you know, from society.
Are you, and for Haley Cullen, are you guys seeing an advantage more than a disadvantage, or with being kind of women entrepreneurs in terms of also obviously not the kind of classic entrepreneur, but do you find ways of making that, let's say,
using the fact that we're women to our advantage?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's unspoken most of the time.
Yeah, I think that might be a little bit of a myth that there's like this like female advantage. It's,
but that it's a strong suit of our company. I think it probably holds more weight than we even realize, but no one really calls it out directly to us. But I think it has a lot of reasons why people want to partner with us. And
like, you know, I would say that you're role models for, you know, other female entrepreneurs and like up and coming, not just female entrepreneurs, but I think, you know, people of color, mm-hmm. or people who are marginalized in terms of like who we see as the face of entrepreneurship.
Yeah. Anyone who thinks that, there's a good chance that they'll be told no.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people. Pika agrees. We would like to encourage.
That's our alarm, I think.
She's signing off.
Signing off from Pikachu. Awesome. Well, thank you, all three of you guys, for coming
today. Thank you, Dong.